Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the Saturday, November 25th, 2023 reading of the Denver Post. My name is Doug Crane. Today we will be reading from the following main articles: Law Enforcement Lawsuits, Watchdog, City Not Complying with Terms, Board Calls for Review of Settlements and Cases Against Denver Agencies, by Saja Hindi, The Denver Post, Israel, Hamas at War, Hostages, Prisoners Swapped, Truces Start Brings Quiet to 2.3 million, Increased Supplies Begin to Enter Gaza, by Najib Jobain, Joseph Fetterman, and Jack Jeffrey, The Associated Press. Aspen, Bank Files Suit Over Loan Defaults, by Justin Wingerter, Business Den. War in Ukraine, Kyiv Aims Drone Attack at Crimea, by Ilya Novikov, The Associated Press. And following up with miscellaneous articles: Law Enforcement Lawsuits, Watchdog, City Not Complying with Terms, Board Calls for Review of Settlements in Cases Against Denver Agencies, by Saja Hindi, The Denver Post. A citizen watchdog board is calling for independent oversight of settlements in lawsuits involving Denver's police and sheriff's departments, saying it found the city has failed to comply with all of the non-monetary terms required by several high-profile agreements, or has missed opportunities for a real change by barely meeting them. Denver's Citizen Oversight Advisory Board sent an open letter Friday to Mayor Mike Johnston and City Council President Jaime Torres, along with the City Auditor, the Department of Public Safety's Executive Director, the City Attorney, and the City's Independent Law Enforcement Monitor. In the six-page letter, the board notes that since the new city council started in July, the elected body has approved payouts of more than $9.5 million for 18 settlements related to Denver police. Since 2022, the council has approved more than $17.3 million in settlements related to the Department of Public Safety. The nine-member board acknowledged financial payouts and lawsuit settlements are more public than some other terms, such as training being required to fix underlying issues. But these non-monetary provisions are often crucial to making systems level or structural changes that can help prevent and avoid future harm, the board's members wrote. The Citizen Board said its review of multiple cases with public settlement agreements showed the city also hasn't used opportunities to build trust by telling people what changes are being made. Armando Saldate, executive director of the Department of Public Safety, which oversees Denver's police and sheriff's departments, disputed the board's contention that the city hadn't fulfilled some settlement terms. While the Citizen Oversight Board may hold opinions that the settlement agreements should have been negotiated differently, the department has complied with the terms that were agreed upon and will continue to be transparent and share improvements with the public to enhance trust in public safety, Saldate said in a statement Friday. The mayor's office, in an unsigned statement, said the Johnston administration is committed to accountability and open to meeting with the board. Citizens' trust that the city will enforce and follow through with settlement agreements is crucial, and we will continue to work diligently to ensure we meet Denverites' expectations, the mayor's office said. But Torres, in a reply sent to Citizen Oversight Board Chief Julia Richmond, said she and other city council members share the board's concerns about compliance with settlements. Every incident, every settlement should have transformational response to an improved level of community and institutional trust, Torres wrote. We welcome an opportunity to meet to discuss a more responsive and responsible future. Because the city doesn't make all the terms of settlement agreements public, the Citizen Oversight Board, in its letter, spotlighted several high-profile cases in which all requirements were published. They include the 2015 death in the Denver jail of Michael Marshall, who was suffering a psychotic episode and died after he aspirated on his own vomit while being restrained face down by deputies for more than 10 minutes by deputies. The 2011 jail assault case of Jamal Hunter, who was attacked by other prisoners and choked by a deputy he had filed a grievance against. The 2006 jail death of Emily Rice, who was ignored and didn't get necessary medical treatment before she bled to death. The board detailed numerous issues in these settlements, including not keeping necessary compliance reports, sending irregular or inconsistent reports, not completing a final investigative report, not publishing investigative findings, and not fully complying with other requirements. In Rice's case, the settlement requirement for a Denver Sheriff Department training video failed to acknowledge the mistakes DSD deputies had made, significantly diminishing the video's training value, and a requirement governing the resolution of conflicts with medical staff, if it had been followed, may have prevented the death of inmate Leroy Taylor after his medical emergency in February of 2022, the board wrote. The board also pointed out that the vast majority of the city's public safety settlements involved the Denver Police Department, yet most of the publicly available settlement terms involved agreements to settle cases brought against the Denver Sheriff Department. Our review of these settlements is sufficient for this board to conclude that a measure of independent oversight of settlements is warranted, not just for legal reasons, but for the welfare of the Denver community as well, the board wrote in its letter. The board requested a meeting with the Department of Safety, the City Attorney's Office, the Board of the Independent Monitor, and the City Auditor's Office. We believe that improving oversight of settlement agreements will meaningfully contribute to both better operational outcomes and a greater degree of community trust in city government and the Department of Safety in particular, the board wrote. A focus on improving policy and process involving public safety settlements will reduce community harm and the risk of additional claims and settlements. Israel, Hamas at war. Hostages, prisoners swapped. Truce's start brings quiet to 2.3 million. Increased supplies begin to enter Gaza. By Najib Jobain, Joseph Fetterman, and Jack Jeffrey, The Associated Press. Rafah, Gaza Strip. Hamas on Friday released 24 hostages it held captive in Gaza for weeks, and Israel freed 39 Palestinians from prison in the first stage of a swap under a four-day ceasefire that offered a small glimmer of relief to both sides. Israel, wrenched by the abduction of nearly 240 people in Hamas's October 7th attack that triggered the war, cheered as 13 Israeli women and children emerged free from Gaza. Most were in their 70s or 80s, and the youngest was a two-year-old. Also released were 10 people from Thailand and one from the Philippines. In Gaza, the truce's start Friday morning brought the first quiet for 2.3 million Palestinians reeling and desperate from relentless Israeli bombardment that has killed thousands, driven three-quarters of the population from their homes, and leveled residential areas. Rocket fire from Gaza militants into Israel went silent as well. Increased supplies of food, water, medicine, and fuel promised under the deal began to roll into Gaza, where UN officials had warned that Israel's seal on the territory threatened to push it to starvation. But relief has been tempered among Israelis by the fact that not all hostages will be freed, and among Palestinians by the briefness of the pause. The short truce leaves Gaza mired in humanitarian crisis and under the threat that fighting could resume soon. Israel says the ceasefire could be extended if more hostages are released, and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office said it had received a new list of hostages to be released by Hamas on Saturday. But Israel has vowed to resume its massive offensive once the truce ends. That has clouded hopes that the deal eventually could help wind down the conflict, which has fueled a surge of violence in the occupied West Bank and stirred fears of a wider conflagration across the Middle East. First hostages freed. Under the deal, Hamas is to release at least 50 hostages and Israel 150 Palestinian prisoners over the 4 days. Both sides were starting with women and children. Israel said the four-day truce can be extended an extra day for every additional 10 hostages freed. After nightfall Friday, a line of ambulances emerged from Gaza through the Rafah crossing into Egypt, carrying the freed hostages, as seen live on Egypt's state-run Al-Qahira TV. The freed Israelis included 9 women and 4 children 9 and under. The released hostages were taken to 3 Israeli hospitals for observation. The Schneider Children's Medical Center said it was treating 8 Israelis, 4 children, and 4 women, and that all appeared to be in good physical condition. The center said they also were receiving psychological treatment, adding that these are sensitive moments for the families. At a plaza dubbed Hostages Square in Tel Aviv, a crowd of Israelis celebrated at the news. Yael Adar spotted her mother, 85-year-old Yaffa Adar, in a TV newscast of the release and was cheered to see her walking. That was a huge concern. What would happen to her health during these almost 2 months, she told Israel's Channel 12. But Yael's 38-year-old son, Tamir Adar, remained in captivity. Both were kidnapped October 7th from kibbutz near Oz. Everyone needs to come back. It's happiness locked up in grief. The hostages included multiple generations. 9-year-old Ohad Munder Zitri was freed along with his mother, Karen Munder, and grandmother Ruti Munder. The fourth grader was abducted during a holiday visit to his grandparents at the kibbutz, where about 80 people, nearly a quarter of all residents of the small community, are believed to have been taken hostage. The plight of the hostages has raised anger among some families that the government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was not doing enough to bring them home. Hours later, 24 Palestinian women and 15 teenagers held in Israeli prisons in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem were freed. In the West Bank town of Batuna, hundreds of Palestinians poured out of their homes to celebrate, honking horns and setting off fireworks that lit up the night sky. The teenagers had been jailed for minor offenses like throwing stones. The women included several convicted of trying to stab Israeli soldiers and others who had been arrested at checkpoints in the West Bank. As a Palestinian, my heart is broken for my brothers in Gaza, so I can't really celebrate, said Abdul Qader Khatib, a UN worker whose 17-year-old son, Iyas, was freed. But I am a father, and deep inside, I am very happy. Iyas had been taken last year into administrative detention without charges or trial and based on secret evidence. Israel often holds detainees for months without charges. Most of those who are tried are put before military courts that almost never acquit defendants, human rights groups say. According to the Palestinian Prisoners Club, an advocacy group, Israel is holding 7,200 Palestinians, including about 2,000 arrested since the start of the war. Cease fire. Friday's halt in fighting brought members of Gaza's uprooted population a moment to catch their breath after weeks of fleeing for shelter, searching for food, and fearing for family. After the truce began Friday morning, 4 trucks of fuel and 4 trucks of cooking gas entered from Egypt, as well as 200 trucks of relief supplies, Israel said. Israel has barred all imports into Gaza throughout the war, except for a trickle of supplies from Egypt. Aspen, bank files suit over loan defaults, by Justin Weingarter, Business Den. As an Aspenite prepares to auction off his $87 million home and ranch next week, a Denver bank is suing him for the $56 million and counting that it said he owes. Dan Burrell, a wealthy entrepreneur with varied business interests, will begin taking bids December 1st on his 8,400-square-foot house on Red Mountain in Aspen and 4,200-acre ranch in nearby Carbondale. Sotheby's lists the package deal for $86.5 million, while saying starting bids may be in the $20 million to $50 million range. First Western Trust Bank said both properties are collateral for Burrell's unpaid loans. In a 40-page lawsuit it filed in Aspen on November 14th, the Denver-based lender detailed negotiations, loans, delays, and defaults between the bank and Burrell in the past 4 years. As of November 3rd, First Western is owed $55,889,835, with interest continuing to accrue, it said. Requests for comment were sent to several of Burrell's companies, but not answered. Burrell and his Burrell Diversified Investments first borrowed $5 million in March 2019 with plans to repay the full amount in a year, according to First Western. The loan was increased to $7.5 million and collateralized by 349,000 shares in Exagen, a diagnostics company. Its maturity date was pushed back to 2021 and then 2022, the bank said, but it was not repaid. Burrell and Burrell Diversified Investments then borrowed an additional $10 million in August 2021 to be repaid by February 2023, according to First Western. That second loan was collateralized by 6800 Upper Cattle Creek Road in Carbondale, the 4,500-acre ranch that will soon go to auction. The loan's maturity date was pushed back to May, the bank said, but it was not repaid. In February 2022, First Western loaned Burrell and his company $34 million to be repaid December 6th. That was collateralized by 768 Hunter Creek Road in Aspen, the 8,400-square-foot house that will soon go to auction. This third loan also hasn't been repaid, according to First Western. Finally, Burrell and Burrell Diversified Investments borrowed $6.1 million in April 2022 to finance construction of a house at 1043 Willits Lane in Basalt. The loan was collateralized by that property, as well as 969 Willits Lane, according to the bank. It has not been repaid. Last year, the loans were collateralized and cross-collateralized to include properties in Eagle County, Florida, and Nantucket, Massachusetts. All four loans are now in default and carry default interest rates of 21%, according to First Western's lawsuit last week. The bank is suing Burrell, Burrell Diversified Investments, and five other companies of his for breach of contract. It is seeking to foreclose on the Exagen stock and some water rights in Eagle County, but not the Aspen or Carbondale properties at this time, it said. First Western is represented by attorneys Trevor Bartell and Francis Ciocia Stott with the Denver office of Lewis Rocha Rothgerber Christie, a Phoenix-based law firm. The listed address of Burrell Diversified Investments is an office suite along Cooper Avenue in Aspen. But in October, its landlord asked the judge to let it evict Burrell Diversified Investments after it stopped paying rent. On November 1st, Judge Ashley Andrews ordered the Pitkin County Sheriff's Office to evict Burrell's company and return the suite to its owner. In recent years, the Burrell subsidiary, Burrell Aviation, has received government contracts around the country to expand air cargo operations. Burrell Aviation has a dozen airports in its portfolio, including Colorado Springs, according to its website. Burrell started the for-profit Burrell College of Osteopathic Medicine at New Mexico State University in Las Cruces. He also has mining, construction, and real estate holdings. War in Ukraine. Kyiv aims drone attack at Crimea, by Ilya Novikov, the Associated Press. Kyiv, Ukraine. Ukraine launched one of its biggest drone attacks on the Moscow-annexed Crimean Peninsula since the full-scale war that started with Russia's invasion 21 months ago. Russian officials said Friday they did not mention any casualties or damage. At the same time, Ukrainian officials reported that the Kremlin's forces escalated their weeks-long and costly attempt to storm Avdiivka, a strategically important city in eastern Ukraine. The intensified efforts came as both sides are keen to show they are not deadlocked as the fighting approaches 2024. Neither side has gained much ground despite a Ukrainian counteroffensive that began in June, and analysts predict the war will be a long one. With winter weather setting in, bringing snow and freezing temperatures to the battlefield, Ukraine and Russia are looking to take ground that could provide platforms for future advances. The Moscow-appointed governor for the Russian-occupied part of southern Ukraine's Kherson region, Vladimir Soldo, said Ukraine launched a major drone attack on Crimea early Friday. He claimed that dozens of drones were shot down over the province and the northern part of Crimea. Russia annexed the peninsula from Ukraine in 2014, a move that most of the world considered illegal and has used it as a staging and supply point during the war. The Russian Defense Ministry said air defenses downed 13 Ukrainian drones over Crimea and three more over southern Russia's Volgograd region. Ukrainian officials did not comment on the Russian reports. It was not possible to independently verify either side's battlefield claims. Russia has been trying to capture Avdiivka since October 10th, using heavy bombardments and reportedly taking heavy losses. The city is wrecked, and the battle has become reminiscent of the fight over the eastern city of Bakhmut, which was largely destroyed during 9 months of fighting before Russian troops eventually captured it. Avdiivka lies in the northern suburbs of Donetsk, a city in a region of the same name that Russian forces partially occupy. Avdiivka's location grants Ukrainian forces artillery advantages over the city and could serve as a springboard for them to liberate Donetsk. After intense artillery and aerial bombardments, Russian troops attacked the heavily fortified city from an additional direction and spread along the line of contact, whereas before they attacked in columns. Vitaly Barabash, the head of Avdiivka's military administration, said Friday, "The city is enduring up to 40 bombardments daily," he said. Fatal property dispute shooting. Woman believed to be girlfriend of suspect also arrested. A woman believed to be the girlfriend of a man suspected of killing three people and wounding a fourth in a property dispute in rural Colorado also is being held in connection with the shooting. The arrest of Nancy Mae Medina Cochis, 50, in New Mexico, was announced Thursday by the Custer County Sheriff's Office in Colorado. It said she is suspected of being an accessory to a crime, pending the continued investigation into Monday's shooting, which killed Robert Gears, 63, his wife, Beth Wade Gears, 73, and James Dalton, 58, near Westcliff, about 77 miles southwest of Colorado Springs. Dalton's wife, Patty Dalton, was wounded. According to court documents, their neighbor, Hammy Clark, yelled about trespassing and started shooting while Robert Gears was talking to a surveyor. Clark was arrested Tuesday near Albuquerque after about 25 hours on the run. Medina Cochis was with him at the time and is believed to be his girlfriend, Sheriff's Office spokesperson Reggie Foster said Friday. A telephone message left for the 11th District Judicial District Attorney's Office on whether prosecutors have filed charges against Clark or Medina Cochis was not immediately returned Friday. It is not known if Clark or Medina Cochis have lawyers representing them. Other neighbors not involved in the shooting have accused Clark of harassing them, denying them court-ordered use of part of his property to access their property, and posting signs saying he was armed, court records said. Black Friday. Merchants offer bigger discounts to lure shoppers. By Andy Innocencio and Alexander Olson, The Associated Press. New York. Shoppers venturing out to malls and stores on Black Friday found perks from champagne to virtual reality experiences and old-fashioned doorbusters as retailers tried to entice customers who are resisting splurges and impulse buying this year. Consumers are under pressure as their savings dwindle and their credit card debt grows. Inflation has eased, but many goods and services such as meat and rent are far higher than they were 3 years ago. Yvonne Carey, 72, was among the first shoppers at Macy's Herald Square store in Manhattan, where she snapped up discounted Michael Kors slippers and UGG boots for herself. But Carey said she plans to stick to the same $1,000 budget as last year as she shops for gifts for her six grandchildren and her husband. "The prices are crazy on everything, food, clothes," Carey said. Many retailers ordered fewer goods for this holiday season and pushed holiday sales earlier in October than last year to help shoppers spread out their spending, a trend that accelerated during the pandemic when clogs developed in the supply network. But this year, retailers said more shoppers were willing to wait until the last minute in hopes of finding better deals. "In this economy, it's really hard. We had to save some gift cards. We've been saving for months ahead to try and make it work, keep it normal," said Damaris Faye Bayard, shopping with her husband and daughter at a mall in Metairie, Louisiana. Gone are the Black Fridays of years ago when consumers would stand in line for hours in the middle of the night or brawls would break out over high-demand items. But Black Friday shopping remains a favorite tradition for many, and retailers try to reward devotees with steeper discounts and other surprises. Tradition every year, get up at 4 o'clock, eat breakfast, and come in the mall and shop all day, said Martha Stewart, singing and giddily looking through her shopping bags at Lakeside Shopping Center in Metairie. Nearby, Janelle Rayford was delighted when workers at Lakeside popped champagne for shoppers. I have champagne and a new pair of shoes in my hand, Rayford said. I just wasn't expecting all of this. At Macy's Herald Square store, the Disney Princess shop had augmented reality, allowing delighted youngsters to virtually step into one of the princess dresses. Shoppers who streamed in soon after the doors opened at 6 a.m. were greeted with discounts of 40% to 60% on footwear, handbags, and diamond jewelry. The customer is under pressure. You see it with what is going on in luxury. That is a recent development, Macy's CEO Jeff Jeanette said in an interview with the Associated Press, adding that shoppers across all income levels are more discerning about how they are spending their budget. About 12,000 customers showed up at Mall of America in Bloomington, Minnesota in the first hour of its 7 a.m. opening, 20% more than last year, said Jill Renslow, executive vice president of business development and marketing for the shopping center. She said she expects sales to be up 3% to 4% at the mall. Stephen Lebovitz, CEO of mall operator CBL Properties, also said traffic was similar or better Friday compared with a year ago, based on a spot check of 18 of its 54 malls. He said more stores brought back doorbuster discounts, a Black Friday hallmark before the advent of online shopping. Rose and Remington gave out $25 gift cards to the first 50 people in line, while JCPenney gave out 200 discount cards every 4 hours. Consumers spent $5.6 billion on Thanksgiving Day when major stores such as Macy's and Kohl's closed and shoppers focused on online shopping, according to Adobe Analytics, which tracks online spending. That was up 5.5% compared with a year ago. For the first 23 days of November, consumers spent $76.7 billion online, up 6.8% from the same period a year ago. Online sales on Black Friday are expected to bring in $9.6 billion, up 5.7% compared with the year-ago period, Adobe said. The National Retail Federation, the nation's largest retail trade group, expects shoppers will spend more this year than last year, but their pace will slow. The group has forecast that U.S. holiday sales will rise 3% to 4% for November through December, compared with 5.4% growth a year ago. The forecast is consistent with the average annual holiday increase of 3.6% from 2010 to pre-pandemic 2019. Americans ramped up spending during the pandemic with money in their pockets from federal relief checks. Online discounts should be better than a year ago, particularly for toys, electronics, and clothing, according to Adobe. It predicts toys will be discounted on average by 35%, compared with 22% a year ago, while electronics should see 30% cuts, compared with last year's 27%. In clothing, shoppers will see an average discount of 25%, compared with 19% last year. Analysts consider the five-day Black Friday weekend, which includes the Monday after the holiday known as Cyber Monday, a key barometer of shoppers' willingness to spend. This year, it has been slow, said Gabriella Santiniello, founder of A-Line Partners, an independent retail research firm in Los Angeles, who had a network of associates scoping out malls and stores in Dallas, Philadelphia, Orlando, Florida, and other parts of the country on Friday. They're getting out to shop, but I don't think they're buying as much. Black Friday is expected to be the busiest shopping day of the year, according to Sensormatic Solutions, which tracks store traffic. But some shoppers who returned to stores for Black Friday for the first time in years were unimpressed by the size of the crowds and the quality of the discounts. Samuel Alves, 44, and his wife bought two computer monitors and a pressure cooker at a Walmart in Germantown, Maryland, but came away disappointed in the discounts. Back in the day, they had these good deals in stores, Alves said. Now, we don't see that anymore. Denver. Man gets 48 years in murder of Cherry Creek district teacher. Melissa Wright was killed in her apartment in 2021 by Saja Hindi. The Denver Post. A 51-year-old Aurora man was sentenced to more than four decades in prison after killing a Cherry Creek school district teacher he had previously dated. Eric Cobain pleaded guilty to second-degree murder with a domestic violence factual basis earlier this year for fatally shooting Melissa Wright. Judge Nakia Bland handed down the 48-year sentence to Cobain, the Denver District Attorney's Office announced on Monday. Wright, 41, was a math teacher at IT Manor, an alternative high school, according to KDVR. Her family called her funny and kind, and they told the TV station that she had a big impact on her students. Denver police found Wright dead in her apartment after responding to calls of gunshots in a Lowry Field area complex on May 28, 2021, according to arrest documents that were previously sealed. In police interviews conducted with other residents in the complex, several people reported hearing gunshot sounds coming from Wright's apartment and had either seen or heard a man who left her apartment that night, the arrest affidavit stated. One person reporting hearing the man yelling obscenities and the woman in the apartment crying. During an autopsy, Wright was found to have bruising, fractures in one arm and one leg, and gunshot wounds. One person told police that Wright and Cobain had been in an on-again, off-again relationship, while another described the couple's relationship as volatile. Police also received information from a woman who said she received a text message in the early morning hours from Cobain saying he did something god-awful that he regretted, but when she called him, his phone was off. Cobain was arrested May 29, 2021, in the 700 block of Kipling Street in Lakewood. Melissa Wright's death was a terrible tragedy that should remind all of us that there is still much work to be done to address the issue of domestic violence, said Denver District Attorney Beth McCann in a statement. I hope this sentence will provide some comfort to Melissa's family. Russia. High inflation is putting consumers in a tight spot, by Anna France, the Associated Press. Moscow. The shelves at Moscow supermarkets are full of fruit and vegetables, cheese and meat, but many of the shoppers look at the selection with dismay as inflation makes their wallets feel empty. Russia's central bank has raised its key lending rate four times this year to try to get inflation under control and stabilize the ruble's exchange rate as the economy weathers the effects of Russia's military operation in Ukraine and the Western sanctions imposed as a consequence. The last time it raised the rate to 15%, doubled that from the beginning of the year, the bank said it was concerned about prices that were increasing at an annualized rate of about 12%. The bank now forecasts inflation for the full year, as well as next year, to be about 7.5%. Although that rate is high, it may be an understatement. If we talk in percentage terms, then probably prices increased by 25%. This is meat, staple products, dairy, produce, fruits, vegetables, sausages. My husband can't live without sausage. Sometimes I'm just amazed at price spikes, said Roxana Gelkova, a shopper in a Moscow supermarket. Asked if her income as a retiree was enough to keep food on the table, customer Lilia Sarkova said, "No, of course not. I get help from my children. Without their assistance, I don't know how to pay rent and food," the 70-year-old said. Figures from the state statistical service Rostat, released on November 1st, show a huge spike in prices for some foods compared with 2022. 74% for cabbage, 72% for oranges, and 47% for cucumbers. The Russian parliament has approved a 2024-2026 budget that earmarks a record amount for defense spending. Maxim Blant, a Russian economy analyst based in Latvia, sees that as an indication that prices will continue to rise sharply. It is simply impossible to solve the issue of inflation in conditions when the military-industrial complex receives unlimited funding, when everything they ask for is given to them, when the share of this military-industrial complex in the economy grows at a very rapid pace, he told the Associated Press.
The central bank's rate hikes have slightly cooled the ruble's exchange rate slide. The rate is now at 88 to the U.S. dollar from more than 100 earlier, but that's still far higher than in summer 2022 when it was about 60 to the dollar. That keeps the cost of imports high, even as import possibilities shrink because of Western sanctions. Texas. High-speed police chases rise near border, locals on edge, by J. David Goodman, The New York Times. Zavala County, Texas. Jairo Lerma and several of his relatives placed a wooden cross in the dry grass along a Texas highway where his parents, on their way from Georgia to Mexico, died suddenly in a fiery crash with an oncoming car that was carrying migrants and fleeing a sheriff's deputy. Shortly before the crash on November 8th, his mother, Isabel, had texted to say that she and her husband, Jose, a retired carpet factory worker from Dalton, Georgia, soon would be at the border. Instead, they died near a bend in the road some 60 miles short, along with five migrants and the 21-year-old driver of the other car. I blame the sheriff's department because they were chasing at a really high speed in a location that was really dangerous, Lerma said. This could have been avoided. In recent years, police departments across the United States have been reassessing when and how to pursue fleeing suspects, adopting policies to curtail the number of dangerous high-speed chases. But in Texas, the state police and sheriff's offices have been notable exceptions, policing experts said, retaining broad discretion to give chase whenever their officers deem it appropriate. The approach differs even from big city departments in the state, such as in Houston, where the police recently banned pursuits for minor offenses. The number of chases across Texas has gone up sharply starting in 2021, when Governor Greg Abbott began a program known as Operation Lone Star and sent thousands of state police officers to patrol the area around the border. The chases, which often erupt suddenly from traffic stops, have left dozens dead and scores injured, including bystanders, rattling border communities from El Paso to Brownsville. High-speed chases are part of Abbott's aggressive approach to a surge in migrant arrivals at the border, a strategy that has led to clashes with the Biden administration. The federal government has looked into the actions by Texas police during Operation Lone Star, including their operations in areas where migrant drownings occurred in the Rio Grande, although no broad action has been taken to curtail the program. In Zavala County, where Lerma's parents were killed, residents have contended with a sharp uptick in chases. The state police alone conducted at least 175 vehicle pursuits in Zavala County during the first 2 years of Operation Lone Star, according to data provided by the department. In the year before the border enforcement program, there were seven. It's dangerous, said Paul Rodriguez, who runs a roadside taco truck with his wife on U.S. 57, where many chases have occurred. It could just come straight at us or people buying food. The owner of a towing company, who has had steady business hauling the wrecked vehicles used by fleeing migrant smugglers, said he advises his family not to drive on U.S. 57. The mayor of Crystal City, the largest community in the sparsely populated Ranchland County, said he avoids the road altogether after having seen the gnarled remains of pursuits. I quit using that highway, said the mayor, Frank Moreno Jr., in an interview at City Hall. After all the years in the Army, for something like that to do me in, I don't think so. The State Department of Public Safety said it counted 29 people killed in pursuits by its troopers in 2021 and 2022, the first 2 years of Operation Lone Star, double the number during the previous 2 years. The figures do not include pursuits by other law enforcement agencies working with the state on Operation Lone Star, the department said. A review of media reports by Human Rights Watch suggested that more than 60 people had been killed in pursuits during Operation Lone Star as of July 2023. A report from the organization was expected Monday. The rise in deaths appeared to closely track the rise in chases by the state police. In South Texas counties along or near the border, chases doubled to 1,100 in 2022 from about 500 in 2019. There were about four times as many in those counties as there were in and around major cities like Dallas and Houston, according to department data. This year, the Federal Customs and Border Protection Agency, whose agents have been involved in a number of deadly chases, imposed new risk assessments and restrictions as part of its pursuit policy. It has evolved pretty dramatically, said Travis Yates, a police trainer and retired major from the Tulsa, Oklahoma Police Department. 30 years ago, most departments chased everyone who fled, he said. You're seeing the trend right now is to give officers very strict parameters. Still, many departments adhere to the old approach of leaving it up to the discretion of individual officers. State police are usually the biggest detractors of limiting pursuits, said Jeffrey Alpert, a criminology professor at the University of South Carolina who has long researched police chases. Their job is traffic. That's what they do. So if someone flees from them, that's an affront. He added that the Texas State Police are very aggressive when it comes to chases. Stephen McCraw, the director of the Department of Public Safety, said in a phone interview that the department relied on its troopers to decide when to start a pursuit and when to call it off. The department, he said, also uses a range of other tools to stop fleeing cars, including following overhead in helicopters, laying stop sticks across the road, or, where available, attaching a GPS tracker during a stop. Such devices have been primarily used in urban settings, a department official said. I would argue you can certainly mitigate risk, McCraw said, but by not giving chase, he added, all you're doing is rewarding the Mexican cartels in their smuggling efforts. He said he expected his troopers to pursue in a judicious manner and that they would be held accountable when they did not exercise appropriate caution. Quite frankly, I think that's a far better approach as opposed to capitulating to the cartels, he said. Abbott has credited Operation Lone Star with thousands of human smuggling arrests, often of U.S. citizens hired to drive migrants away from border counties. A new law, set to go into effect next year, raises the penalty for smuggling to a minimum of 10 years. Many of the drivers are Texans who are recruited with the promise of quick money, said Sergeant Rosilio Lopez Jr., a deputy in the Zavala County Sheriff's Office. A lot of them are teenagers that we are pursuing, he said in an interview during a recent patrol before dawn. The crash that killed Lerma's parents remained under investigation. Chief Deputy Ricardo Rios said the policy of the Zavala County Sheriff's Office was to rely on a deputy's discretion, taking into account the location, whether in town or on the highway, as well as traffic on the road. In September 2021, Gabriel Salazar, a 19-year-old from San Antonio with a significant social media following, died in a crash along with three migrants while fleeing a traffic stop in Crystal City. A sheriff's deputy used a tire deflation device before the crash, the department said. Salazar was driving a white Chevrolet Camaro, which he had purchased with his mother's help only days before, said his sister, Dana Salazar. He was so excited when he got it, she said. The family had tried to bring a case against the police, whom they blamed for the crash, but could not find a lawyer to represent them, Salazar said. He had a lot of goals, she said of her brother. He was trying to become a model. Zavala County, once an industrial producer of spinach, does not sit directly along the Rio Grande, but provides a connection between the border town of Eagle Pass and Interstate 35. During his patrol, Lopez pointed out places used to hide migrants waiting for a pickup along the highways, an abandoned home now filled with discarded clothes and backpacks, a hiding spot in the brush. Beyond the fences of one ranch, an abandoned SUV that had been involved in a crash last year sat lodged in a stand of mesquite trees near some bellowing cattle. They went from the highway to here, said Eddie Gomez, a ranch worker. He said migrants still pass through the hunting ranch regularly on foot, cutting the fence and occasionally allowing deer to escape. In recent months, residents said, the number of pursuits appeared to decline. Still, the fear of a sudden chase loomed. For the annual spinach festival in Crystal City, where a painted 1930s statue of Popeye stands prominently in front of City Hall, the city manager, Felix Benavides, said he positioned police cars as protection in case a fleeing suspect crashed through the celebration. As a city manager, that's my main worry, Benavides said. These are the problems we are facing in America. Iceland, Volcano's Eruption Threat is Ebbing, but Nation Waits, by Claire Moses, The New York Times. The likelihood that a volcanic eruption will engulf the fishing town of Grindavik, Iceland, is decreasing by the day, officials said Friday, even as they continue to warn that an eruption could still occur. Grindavik, with more than 3,000 people, was evacuated this month after it was determined that a 9-mile-long underground river of magma was moving beneath the town to the ocean. Residents are allowed to go home during the day to check on their properties and belongings, but until scientists give the all clear, people cannot return permanently, said John Thor Viglundsson, a spokesperson for Iceland's Department of Civil Protection and Emergency Management. Seismic activity has caused Grindavik to sink and has damaged the sewage system. As a result, the town cannot access cold water, he said. Sewage is a problem, and sewage lines are ruptured, he added. Damage to individual buildings has been limited, Viglundsson said, but because Grindavik sits on a fault line, the damage to infrastructure is great and affects most of the town. Since late last month, tens of thousands of earthquakes have been reported in the Reykjanes Peninsula in southwestern Iceland, sometimes more than 1,000 in a single 24-hour period. That seismic activity led scientists to conclude that an eruption might be imminent, and for much of the past couple of weeks, officials warned of an eruption within days, putting Iceland in a holding pattern. The emergency level has been lowered since. About 300 earthquakes were detected in the area Tuesday, followed by about 100 on Wednesday, according to the Icelandic Met Office, the country's weather service, which said it was considerably less than in recent days. The magnitude of the earthquakes has decreased as well. If that continues, the likelihood of an imminent volcanic eruption diminishes with time, according to the Weather Service. Still, it said an eruption along the underground magma river remained plausible. Iceland, a country of fewer than 400,000 people and about 130 volcanoes, has a long history of seismic activity. Most of its volcanoes are active. The country straddles two tectonic plates, which are divided by an undersea mountain chain. Colorado's End-of-Life Options Act, how one Boulder resident died her way. Maxine Pogreba, 99, became one of the oldest in state to use medical aid in dying, by Amber Carlson, Daily Camera. The last morning of 99-year-old Maxine Pogreba's life played out just as she planned it. She wore a teal dress suit given to her by her late husband, the father of her three children. A group of about 15 people, family members, loved ones, and hospice workers, had gathered in Maxine's small apartment in the Brookdale Senior Living Facility to spend just a few more hours together. They spent that early fall morning telling jokes, reading poems, sharing stories, laughter, and warmth. Eventually, it came time for Maxine to do what she had spent so long preparing to do. Various family members had tried to talk her out of it, but her mind was made up. On October 1st, a few months shy of her 100th birthday, Maxine became one of the oldest people in Colorado to take advantage of the state's End-of-Life Options Act, which allows terminally ill people to access medical aid in dying. Her family remained by her side as she took a potent cocktail of drugs, drifted off to a peaceful sleep, and finally took her last breaths. Medical aid in dying isn't legal everywhere. Apart from Colorado, only 9 states, Oregon, Washington, Montana, Vermont, California, Hawaii, New Jersey, Maine, and New Mexico, and the District of Columbia allow it. And even where it's legal, it is often taboo and not discussed openly. But Maxine's surviving family members said she felt strongly about having this option available to her at the end of her life. And although some of them initially were uncomfortable with the idea, they came to support her decision. Some of them said they now hope to create more awareness around medical aid in dying. Early life. Mary Maxine Albro was born March 4, 1924, to a farmer and a rancher. She, her parents, and 8 siblings lived in Willow Creek, Montana, less than 40 miles west of Bozeman. In 1944, Maxine married her first husband, Dean Pogreba, who had just finished his officer's training for the military. He joined the Air Force and became a combat pilot while she worked as a secretary. The two moved around, living on military bases across the U.S. and Europe. Dean was deployed to serve in World War II, then in the Korean War. In between deployments, he came home. The couple had three children. Dean's deployment in Vietnam would be his last. He was shot down in 1965. Although Dean officially was declared missing in action, he was presumed to have died. He was 43 at the time, while Maxine was 41. Two of Maxine's three children still lived at home. At that time, Maxine and her family were living in Wichita, Kansas, near the base where Dean had been stationed. After his death, Maxine took a family trip back home to Montana and made a detour through Boulder. She liked it so much that she decided they would stay the night. The next morning, she found the home she eventually would buy. "She just kind of fell in love with it," said Lori Littlewood, Maxine's granddaughter. "It's a university town. Her kids could decide to go to school there, and it was close enough to an airport that she could still go and visit who she needed to." Maxine and her kids finally made the move to Boulder in 1967. At first, she worked while taking classes at the University of Colorado and a community college. Eventually, she met her second husband, Bob Burrell, and they traveled the world together until Burrell's death in 1994. Maxine would spend most of the rest of her life in Boulder, apart from a 15-year stint back in Bozeman. "Just let me go." Maxine's family members remember her as gregarious, vivacious, and full of life, and they say she enjoyed many years of good health. Maxine kept an organic garden and loved walking, skiing, and swimming. Karen Shepherd, one of her daughters, said her mother had taught her the importance of eating well, and she remembers doing a lot of active things together as a family. "Maxine loves sports. She loved watching sports and doing them for fun," said Karen. "She played basketball up until she was in her 70s and 80s. She'd take the kids down to the basketball court and play. She could still walk on her hands when she was in her early 60s. She really stayed strong." Karen said Maxine was also the kind of person whose energy could fill a room. People were really drawn to her. "She had a lot of natural charm," she said. "When she walked into a room, people gravitated toward her. And everywhere I went, people always told me how much they loved my mom and shared stories about her." Yet for as lively as she was, Maxine always somehow seemed at ease with the idea of death. According to her younger daughter, Beverly, Maxine and her second husband, Bob, were members of the Hemlock Society, now called End of Life Choices, which advocated for the right to die and supported legislation allowing medical aid in dying. "She would drop some little hints to me sometimes. She'd say, 'It should be the same for people as it is for animals. You should be able to just say goodbye to them,'" Beverly said. "There was always something in her. She just really dreaded thinking she'd end up in a hospital. I think that was her biggest fear." Karen has similar memories of her mother saying she never wanted to lose her independence or lose control of her life. She would say, "If I ever come to that point where I'm in bed or I have to be fed, that kind of thing, just let me go," Karen said. Maxine's choice. Colorado voters voted to legalize medical aid in dying in 2016. Medical aid in dying allows terminally ill people to request a prescription for a cocktail of medications that hastens their death. Patients who wish to access it have to be terminally ill with a prognosis of 6 months or less to live, and they also have to be mentally competent and physically able to request and take the medication. When someone requests the prescription, two doctors also must approve the request. Maxine's health began a long, slow period of decline. She started having brief strokes, which would last only a few minutes. She began losing a significant amount of weight. Her hearing and eyesight gradually grew worse. Over the years, the brief strokes became more frequent. Maxine had cardiac events, including a major one that felt like it could be the end for her. At a certain point, family said that Maxine became afraid that she would be incapacitated and lose her independence. "She was very fearful that she would have a major stroke and then linger," Laurie said. She was always active and engaged, and she just didn't want to not only be dependent, but I think lose her dignity. When Maxine first started talking to family members about using medical aid in dying this summer, a few of them tried to talk her out of it. It was a hard thing for some to accept, Laurie said, because she still seemed healthy overall and mentally sharp. Don't you want to be 100? They would ask. I just don't want to, she said. Thank you for joining us for the Saturday, November 25th, 2023 reading of the Denver Post. My name is Doug Crane.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.